It's November 26, 1941, on Etarafu Island on the northeast coast of Japan. Lieutenant Commander Sadao Chigusa stands on the deck of the destroyer Akigumu as snow falls gently from the sky. Chigusa is dressed in a heavy coat over his imperial uniform, but it does little to stave off the biting cold. A bugle sounds, and Chigusa stiffens his back as he watches his ship disembark from Hitokapu Bay along with the rest of the full strike fleet. Even through his white gloves, Chigusa's fingers are freezing. But he is starting to feel more optimistic about their mission now it has officially begun. He looks across at the other vessels as they sail away from this barren island and finds encouragement in the number and power of them. As he watches the frost-covered ships pull their anchors and follow each other out to sea, he marvels at the majestic sight. Along with the Akigumo, their fleet consists of 8 more destroyers, 2 battleships, 3 cruisers, 3 submarines, 7 oil tankers, and 6 aircraft carriers. Once the fleet has sailed far enough from port, the battleships fire test rounds back at the snow-capped island. Men cheer as impressive explosions burst along the unoccupied landscape they've left behind. Just 3 days earlier, along with most other officers, Chigusa was finally informed of the top-secret mission that this fleet has been assembled for. The news astounded him. It seemed impossible, suicidal even. But Chigusa has since forced himself to overcome his doubts. Besides, he has no choice but to follow orders. The fleet has begun its 2-week journey across the North Pacific toward the U.S. territory of Hawaii, over 3,000 miles away. Once close enough, they will carry out a mission so shocking that its consequences will be heard around the world. In a few days' time, on December 6, 1941, this fleet will make final preparations to launch a surprise attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is December 6th. The Japanese prepare. It's early January 1941 in the Japanese office of Admiral Isokuro Yamamoto, Commander-in-Chief of the Combined Imperial Japanese Fleet. It's 11 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Admiral Yamamoto sits at his desk, composing a letter in handwriting so beautiful that his subordinates often remark on it. In the letter, he outlines what he considers to be an equally beautiful plan, a preemptive strike against a country with whom Japan is not currently in conflict. Yamamoto writes with his right hand and steadies the paper with what remains of his left. 2 of his fingers on his left hand were blown off when he was 20 years old during a war with Russia. Now he is 57. And as a result of his distinguished military career, he has garnered a well-earned reputation for bravery and strategic genius. Yamamoto enjoys extreme popularity among his men, both with the high-ranking officers and the lower-ranking sailors. He, in turn, thinks highly of them. In his letter, he praises their service to the Emperor. His entire plan hinges on their courage, the determination and sacrifice of Japan's naval personnel, and he's confident they are up to the task. For many Japanese, the proposed attack that Yamamoto is planning is essential to protecting their country. The United States has remained largely neutral throughout the Second World War. Still, there are some that feel their involvement is inevitable and imminent. Japan is allied with the fascist countries of Germany and Italy, who are at war with Great Britain, America's principal ally. Furthermore, President Roosevelt has already implemented harsh trade sanctions on Japan and moved his Pacific Fleet from the American mainland to the islands of Hawaii, ever closer to Japan. War with America seems unavoidable. And if that's the case, Yamamoto is preparing to strike first. Yamamoto knows that with their economic advantages, America would win a long, drawn-out conflict. So to secure victory over America, Japan must launch a large-scale surprise attack on America's Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. His letter proposes that a fleet of Japan's most powerful ships should be sent to Pearl Harbor to destroy the bulk of America's naval power in one swift and decisive blow. He wants Japanese airplanes to take off from aircraft carriers and swarm over the enemy ships in an airborne assault similar to the successful attacks the Germans have launched in Europe. He also wants submarines to penetrate the harbor and fire torpedoes at the American vessels. And he wants all of it to happen fast and soon. He writes that, if favored by God's blessing, such an opening gambit would destroy American morale and secure an early victory for Japan. As he lays down his pen, Yamamoto knows his scheme will be met with resistance from naval headquarters. There are many in the Imperial Japanese military who will tell him that his ideas are both impossible and unwise. He blows the ink dry and reads his three-page letter back to himself. It's a strong plan, he assures himself, and a necessarily aggressive one. Until recently, Yamamoto has been seen as a pacifist in Japan, but Yamamoto now understands the situation is unavoidable. Sealing the fine quality paper within an envelope, he then mails it to the Minister of the Navy. If his plan meets with any political resistance, he is prepared to offer his resignation. A month later, a copy of Yamamoto's highly classified letter is handed to one of the most famous fighter pilots in Japan. Commander Minoru Genda slices open the letter with a paper knife and reads the proposal. He served under Admiral Yamamoto 8 years earlier, and they share similar ideas. They both firmly believe the aircraft carrier is key to future victory in combat. As he reads Yamamoto's impeccable handwriting, Genda finds himself agreeing with Yamamoto that if a war must be fought against America, then it must be won within 6 months. Surprise is the all-important factor. Over the coming weeks, Yamamoto and Genda work out the details. They decide that 6 aircraft carriers must be included in the fleet. This way, a 2 or even 3-wave attack can be achieved from the sky. And soon, Yamamoto's plan is authorized and put into motion. A highly powerful and top-secret fleet of ships will cross the Pacific, avoiding detection by the enemy. And by December 6, 1941, this fleet will position itself within striking distance of Hawaii, preparing to launch a devastating and unprecedented surprise attack. It's December 6, 1941, on the island of Oahu, Hawaii, one day before the attack on Pearl Harbor. A young, long-haired Japanese man in an unbuttoned Hawaiian shirt wakes up in bed in his tiny residence on the grounds of the Japanese consulate. He's exhausted and hungover again. His name is Tadashi Morimura, or at least that's what he tells people. Officially, he works in Oahu at the consulate, helping Japanese locals with their bureaucratic issues. But that's his cover story. His real name is Takeo Yoshikawa, and he's a spy for the Japanese Imperial Navy. Yoshikawa's head is still stinging from the shots he downed in an American bar the night before. Making matters worse, someone is banging loudly on his front door. He hauls himself up, stumbles to the door, and opens it. The man standing on the other side is a clerk from the consulate. He's come by to collect Yoshikawa's daily report. Yoshikawa knows the clerk dislikes him for his drinking, his tardiness, his insubordination, not to mention the prostitutes he sometimes brings back to his residence. But Yoshikawa is also confident that he brings a lot to the table. The clerk may not like him, but he is fully aware that Yoshikawa's intelligence is extremely valuable, especially lately. For weeks now, the clerk has been pressuring Yoshikawa to gather information about any activity related to Pearl Harbor. Specifically, the Japanese intelligence services want to know what American battleships, aircraft carriers, cruisers, and other vessels are currently in port. They also want to know where these vessels are positioned. They're asking the right man. Yoshikawa is an expert in the habits of the U.S. Navy. He knows the names and details of every ship in Pearl Harbor and can provide his superiors in Tokyo a thorough and daily update of their comings and goings. His spying methods are simple. He takes a taxi past the fleet, pretending to be a sightseer, and studies Pearl Harbor from a nearby peninsula. To avoid suspicion, he never carries a camera, binoculars, or a notebook. All his reports are crafted from memory. This week, though, at the insistence of his Japanese handlers, he's taken to the skies. He rented a small airplane and has been observing the naval base from above. He even donned his bathing suit, dove into the harbor, and used a hollow reed as a breathing device to get a view from the water. Today, he informs the clerk that 2 of the U.S. Navy's most valuable aircraft carriers, the Enterprise and the Lexington, are not currently in port. The clerk scribbles down these details into his notepad. Yoshikawa can tell by his disappointed response that this isn't the news his superiors wanted to hear. Yoshikawa, of course, doesn't know the details, but he can tell something huge is about to happen. Lately, the clerk's questions have been specific and urgent. Yoshikawa is starting to suspect that some sort of attack upon Pearl Harbor is imminent. He hopes he can watch it from his favorite position on the peninsula with a beer in hand. Soon, the clerk leaves Yoshikawa and immediately takes the report back to his superiors. They, in turn, arrange for an encrypted message to be sent to the secret Japanese fleet out in the Pacific. This strike fleet is currently 230 miles north of Hawaii, close enough to launch planes should the order be given. The sailor hands Commander Genda the report that the spy Yoshikawa gave earlier today. Genda curses when he learns about the two carriers that are not moored in Pearl Harbor as expected. As far as he is concerned, the destruction of such dangerous vessels is the principal objective of the operation. But Genda still feels they are poised for a glorious victory. The same intelligence report also confirms that the rest of America's Pacific Fleet lie awaiting their fate in Pearl Harbor. The Japanese strike force is now so close to Hawaii that the radio operators begin to pick up commercial stations from the islands. The carefree sounds of a ukulele and steel drums indicate to Commander Genda that the island has absolutely no idea of what is about to hit it. At 6 o'clock on the following morning, before the sun will have a chance to rise, the Japanese Imperial Navy will begin carrying out Yamamoto's devastating plan. The first wave of airplanes will take off from the fleet's aircraft carriers, and within 15 minutes, 183 of them will take to the skies, on their way to rain terror down from above. It's December 6th, 1941, in the North Pacific Ocean, minutes before midnight. Aboard the battleship Akigumo, Executive Officer Sadao Chikuza sits in his cabin, pen and paper in hand. He writes in his diary that, "We are in the very day to which we have been looking forward so eagerly." Since he watched the fleet leave Hitokapu Bay 2 weeks earlier, Chikuza and the rest have sailed 3,000 miles across largely tranquil seas, with their submarines sailing ahead to ensure they wouldn't encounter any American ships. Chikuza was worried that U.S. planes patrolling the ocean might spot them, but none have flown overhead, and he thanks God for the good luck. By now, the fleet has received final permission to attack Pearl Harbor. Many of the men, including his officers, cheer when they hear the order has been given, but Chikuza conducts himself with stoic dignity. He has an older brother who works in a hotel in Hawaii. He prays that his brother will be spared from the destruction that Chikuza himself will be bringing. The following morning, just before 6 o'clock, Chikuza stands on the deck of the destroyer Akigumo. Temperatures on this side of the ocean are much warmer, so even at this early hour, he no longer needs his heavy coat and gloves. Like every other man on deck, he waits with anticipation to see the signal that will launch their attack upon America. Then, on the middle mast of the first aircraft carrier, a set of flags start to move up and down. This is the signal for the first wave of planes to take off. The men on deck are excited. The moment they've been preparing for is here. Chikuza watches as the first wave of planes fly into an inky blue sky. The sound of their engine sends a chill through Chikuza's spine. He watches with awe as the planes disappear into the sky on their way to initiate what he hopes will be the most violent and shocking aerial attack in the history of war. Next on History Daily, December 7th, 1941, the Imperial Japanese Navy commences its attack on Pearl Harbor. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily. Hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing and sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by James Benmore. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.